Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper, man. I'm just kidding. That was my Wolfman Jack impersonation. Oh. Do you know who Wolfman Jack is?
No.
Well, with me today is my co-host and wealth of knowledge here, Mr. Spencer Wolfman Jack Williams.
Yes, I 100% understand that reference and all the implications that come along with it.
And I am your host, Eduardo Villanueva, as well. And we got a great show in store for you, as we're going to be talking about a recently dropped movie out of the repertoire of Mr. Quentin Tarantino, and that is Once Upon a Time, in Hollywood. So that's actually the title.
Yeah, you have to remember those ellipses.
I keep forgetting about it every time I write it, so stick around as we dive into that movie and do a little bit of a conversation about it, because a lot of people are talking about it, and we figured we'll throw our hat in the ring of that. So before we do, Spencer, give him an opening credits.
The Filmlosophers podcast is brought to you by the groovy Mingle Media TV and the boss, VGB Studios. These guys are a complete gas.
Righteous.
Each Wednesday morning, cruise on over and download the latest episodes on your favorite streaming platforms such as Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, and now Pandora.
Pandora!
Can you dig it? You can get You can get the skinny on all our righteous ways on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Far out, man!
Oh my god.
Finally, start dipping in our Kool-Aid. It's so... I don't care if it's time period appropriate, that is just not okay. I don't want anyone dipping in my Kool-Aid, but I'm more than welcome to talk with people.
That was great. That was perfect. I got everything. I wanted out of that. So.
We have an episode archive. They're on filmlosophers.com. Take a listen.
I literally rewrote all of this copy just so that Spencer could say all these things, and I am not sad in the least. And speaking of being sad, we're going to be talking about this week's movie, and that is Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This movie has been making waves for a lot of different reasons, not just for the fact that it's Quentin Tarantino's latest film, because everybody knows the prolific Quentin Tarantino and his certain directing style, but also for a lot of things throughout the film that are done, a lot of the ways people are personified and so forth. So we're going to talk about all of that, because it's just really top of mind for everybody. So before we do, Spencer, give him that official synopsis goodness while I burp quietly into the mic.
That's the wrong way to do that. Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood visits 1969 Los Angeles, where everything is changing, and TV stars Rick Dalton and his longtime stunt double Cliff Booth make their way around an industry they hardly recognize anymore.
That's true. Directed by Quentin Tarantino, the film stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie, and Al Pacino. It also has a couple of roles for people like Emile Hirsch. You have Kurt Russell. There's quite a few people in here that frequent the, the Quentin Tarantino movies, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Because even I mentioned in one of the scenes, the woman who is in his movie Death Proof is in this movie as well. And she's the driver. But like I said, there's a lot of different people, a lot of different great pop-ups and everything. Even Timothy Olyphant, he's in it. You got Dakota Fanning, Bruce Dern, Luke Perry, one of his last roles is in this film. So that's actually kind of cool and sad, because this was him in this movie.
Yeah, when I saw his credit, I was like, wait a minute. Didn't something happen to him?
But then you have like a lot of little pop-ups, like Michael Madsen, who's a frequenter of all of Quentin Tarantino's movies. He's in this movie. Lena Dunham. You even have Harley Quinn Smith, who plays one of the girls in this movie. One of Yeah, one of the girls in this movie. I don't want to jump into it too soon. There's a lot of people that come out, and you'll recognize them as soon as you see them. But it's pretty cool. Zoe Bell is her name. Zoe Bell. Zoe Bell is the woman who is she is also a stunt woman, and she does some acting as well. You may know her as the stunt woman driver in Death Proof. Mm. So bits of knowledge. Tarantino has said he worked on the screenplay for 5 years and considers this screenplay as, quote, probably his most personal. I don't know how I feel about that. I take that back. I have a couple things on that particular perspective that I would add, but I don't know how I feel about that. Him saying that it's probably his most personal.
I need more context of like how
is it your most personal? Well, that's a great question. Another piece of information: this movie received a 7-minute standing ovation at the Cannes film premiere, where it premiered,
right?
At the Cannes Film Festival, which is over in France.
7 minutes.
That's a long time.
That is.
Yeah, the budget. A couple of the numbers for this movie: the budget sits at $90 million domestically for its open. For its budget, and then domestic openings this weekend sat at $41 million altogether. Because I don't believe it's been released overseas yet, the totals of the box office numbers as of today, which, mind you, it's only Tuesday and the opening weekend was just this past weekend, so totals as of today sit at $45.7 million. So okay. It's doing well,
yeah,
needless to say. I don't know how smart it was to consider going up against movies like Lion King and other particular films that debuted around this time. But, I mean, hey, more power to Quentin. I mean,
hey, if you're confident in your movie and you want to go against the king,
because it's his most personal.
Yeah. Why not take on the king that Disney is?
So, Spencer, I want to ask you right away, because I know we've discussed in terms of like the different elements of Quentin Tarantino off the air, and we've kind of gone back and forth. But I've never asked you the most basic of questions, and that is, how familiar are you with Quentin Tarantino's work?
Why do you have to ask such prodding questions on the podcast? Could you not have asked this 2 hours ago?
No.
What? Okay, probably not as familiar as I should be. I've seen, maybe two movies that I can think of off the top of my head.
You've seen maybe two movies
from him. I've seen more than two movies in my lifetime.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's been more than two movies that he's made.
Yeah, I know. He keeps advertising this as his ninth, so I know this one is the ninth one.
Okay, so you are not familiar in terms of seeing a lot of his work, but you're familiar with like his style and kind of the way he's been personified and even caricatured in like certain cartoons or even comedic things. Like, I know, who is it? I don't know if it was Seth MacFarlane has a comedy short, like a little animated short of him being the person, the Moyle, the person who cuts the foreskin off of babies. It's really ridiculous, but like the way his mannerisms and everything, it's very interesting and reminiscent of like how he does his interviews and stuff. So I don't know if that's what you're familiar with.
I'm more familiar with the actual movies than the actual person, I would say.
So you've seen movies he's directed. What about any movies that he starred in?
No, I haven't seen.
Like he starred in From Dusk Till Dawn. He was also in Planet Terror.
I didn't see that one.
He was in Django Unchained. He was the Australian.
He was?
Yeah, he was the Australian. He was the Australian person, the slave person, the trafficker.
Okay, well, I've apparently seen that then. I was unaware.
So, okay, it's good to know where you stand. Where you stand?
Yeah, I've seen three movies, and that is four if you want to count Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2 as separate movies.
They are separate movies. That's a good way. Yeah, count them.
He originally was going to do one long-ass movie.
Well, thankfully he didn't, because I would have cut out halfway through that bad boy.
Okay, so it was that, those two, Inglourious Bastards, and then Django, and now this one.
There you go.
So I've seen half.
Yeah, you've seen half. I've seen Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, both Kill Bills, Grindhouse, like I said, Death Proof, mm-hmm. And he had a role in Planet Terror, which Planet Terror and Death Proof were a part of the Grindhouse movie that came out, mm-hmm. between him and Eli Roth and Robert Rodriguez and them. Okay. I also saw him in Inglourious Basterds as well. Django Unchained. I hadn't seen The Hateful Eight yet. I hear good things about it, but I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Okay.
But also, like I said, I've also seen a lot of his starring roles where he's had a chance to actually be in the film and not so much just somebody who is, you know, like he played the priest or the preacher in what's that Adam Sandler movie? Little Nicky.
Oh.
Remember the blind preacher?
That's a long time ago since I've seen that movie.
Ah, it's still somebody. And then obviously like his roles in like Pulp Fiction, and he was Mr. Brown in Reservoir Dogs, and he was in From Dusk Till Dawn. He's had a slew of different roles and whatnot. Needless to say, this man has permeated through pop culture and is recognized as a film icon. Needless to say, I think most young people during the 90s who were old enough or remember can recall how his film style kind of epitomized what the 90s niche kind of film market looked like. You know, you had movies, like I said, Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, which both of those were in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
They're both like some of the highlights, if you will, of his career, because if you ask anybody, I think they're even on lists, but like if you ask anybody, like, hey, what's your favorite Quentin Tarantino movie? 9 times out of 10, I'm pretty sure most of them are going to say Pulp Fiction. Mm. And for good reason too. Pulp Fiction has essentially like made a name out of Quentin Tarantino, and it isn't exactly like lightning in a bottle. He did an M. Night Shyamalan, that crap. Like, he wasn't like,
thank goodness,
this is my first movie and boom, and everybody loves me. And then after that, it's just downhill. No. Pulp Fiction was like his third full-length film. Not feature film, like being thrown into like theaters and whatnot. But it's like his third film in his filmography, full-length. Because you had like Reservoir Dogs before that. I think he even did a film called, My Best Friend's Birthday. Which, go figure, I don't know what that's about. I haven't seen that one. Huh. But nevertheless, you know, you take Pulp Fiction, and everybody knows the John Travolta dance with the, you know, the two fingers and with him and Uma Thurman, and everybody remembers, like, the two, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's whole, like, Ezekiel 29:17, the path of the righteous man is set, you know, all those things, like what he says. Have you seen Pulp Fiction?
No.
Holy shnikes. Okay, so we're going to have to work on that. but needless to say, he is most notable for his impact in cinema starting in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not his style has kind of transgressed and changed for the better in time has yet to be seen. Like, I'm not one to say that right now. Like, you look at a lot of his movies during the 90s and even early 2000s, like you take a look and you see movies like Kill Bill. Well, Kill Bill 1, yeah. But like Jackie Brown, Pulp Fiction, all those are all the 90s movies. Like Jackie Brown, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs. Those movies were unique in itself because you look at movies like take, for instance, Reservoir Dogs. Reservoir Dogs is a great piece of cinema because of the fact that it's not overly, like, it doesn't deliver everything on a silver platter for you to see, like, oh, here, this is what we're doing. Take this. and it's yours, so you know exactly what we're doing from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in Reservoir Dogs where Michael Madsen's character is currently torturing a cop. And as he's torturing them, he leans in he takes a knife and he leans in and he essentially goes for the guy's head. You don't know what this guy is going to do. You just know he's going to go down and he's going to cut something. So as it's happening, the camera pans up, looks up at the ceiling, and you just hear this cop scream out and cry and like grunting and whatnot. And then the camera pans back down and the guy's in a bloody mess and Michael Madsen has the guy's ear in his hand. And mind you, you didn't see it, but you're left to the imagination of like, oh my God, how did he do it? Did he do it in like a sawing motion? Does he have a knife that's so sharp that it cuts through it like, you know, hot knife through butter? Or like, did he do it savagely, or did he do it like with finesse? How ruthless was he? How all these things are left to your own devices. Like, you make up how ruthless this character can be, essentially. And then you fast forward like a decade or two and you come to a movie like, what do you call it? Django Unchained, mm-hmm. 2012. And Django Unchained has got to be one of the more bloodier films I've seen in a long time. Because you take Django Unchained and you essentially have a shooting gallery of balloons with red paint in that last scene. And everybody is like just splattered all over every wall. And there's no like explanation for it at all. So needless to say, just my little rant on Quentin Tarantino. I don't know if his work has gotten better over the years, but it is interesting.
That's a good word for it, I think.
Like, that's the only word I can think of. It's like, how do you describe somebody who has become so infamous for his work in the 90s, and yet his work doesn't necessarily veer away from what his stamp looks like from the 90s, but is it exactly going in the right direction, you know? Mm. And that leads me to the conversation about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So as we mentioned, we already mentioned, you know, obviously what the premise of the film was and what it was about. But going into this conversation, what were some of your expectations? Like, what were you expecting coming into this movie?
Well, so of the films I mentioned, you know, most of those are very bloody.
That's true.
So I was expecting like there to be like this shift like midway through where like the mob's involved or something, and like he's like either having to fight his like mob people or something. I expected it to be super bloody at some point in the movie.
Yeah.
And really that's kind of the only thing I was thinking about.
That's it?
Yeah.
I'm in that same boat somewhat. Like, I know from the direction most of his movies later on have become, obviously with like things like Death Proof and, oh my gosh, Kill Bill 1 and 2. Like, they literally had to turn one of the last scene in Kill Bill 1 to black and white so that it could be still shown in theaters because of how much blood there was in. Like, that's the rumor. I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't know.
It sounds cool. It does.
Like, but nevertheless, I imagine that this film was going to continue getting more and more chaotic, mm-hmm. I guess is the better word. Because every single film after 2000s just seems to be like this hodgepodge of chaos and action and blood and craziness. That's what I expected out of this, because that's what you got out of Django Unchained. I think because of the fact that I didn't see The Hateful Eight, my most recent experience with Quentin Tarantino's movies is Django Unchained, and that is exactly what you get. Like, there's literally a line in the movie, "I like the way you die, boy." Like, how am I supposed to interpret that? What are you doing, Jamie Foxx? So I think one of the things I was expecting was obviously blood and guts and, or at least just graphic violence. Like, I've never seen him shy away from graphic violence, especially like in movies like Inglourious Basterds. Inglourious Basterds, he's like the Jew bear and everything. Oh my gosh, he's insane.
Yeah, that was a crazy movie.
You have what's his name? Brad Pitt scalping Nazis and flamethrowers to everybody, and it's just that, oh my gosh, the complete evisceration, if you will, of Adolf Hitler by that machine gun by Eli Roth in that movie. I don't think there was anything left of that, whatever that was, to begin with. So I think that was one thing I was going to recognize. This movie was going to be graphic. This movie was going to definitely take it to the level of like Quentin Tarantino graphicness. But one of the other things I was hoping for, and mind you, I had all the information, all the little tidbits that I had given, I hadn't read any of that prior to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had the expectation of, if this is a Quentin Tarantino movie, there are certain rules of consistency that I'm expecting.
Okay.
There are certain, I guess, I don't want to say tropes, because they're not really tropes. They're just very trademarkish, I guess, if you want to say. Like, they're very well known. He's very well known for doing certain things and taking things in certain directions. And so I was hoping for a lot of those. That's honestly what I was hoping for.
Hmm.
So with that said, kind of diving in the film, what was your, leaving the theater, what was your first impression after leaving the theater? Because I know we both went to go see it, and we really talked little to none after we left, because I'm like, I'm saving all of my thoughts from leaking out of my head for when we record. So
okay. So two things like just jump out. One was just the ending, how it just like went from, you know, just a moderate pace to, oh, this insane thing is now happening right now, and just takes up the rest of the ending. I was like, okay, that's odd. And then the other odd one for me was just the hippie people that are in this movie. The first time we go to like the hippie compound in this movie, it's like we stepped into a different movie for a quick second. Because just the tones of everything, of how the movie had been going up to that point, had been one way, and then once we're in this scene, it was just a hard right into just like this creepy type atmosphere where you're looking at these people and you're like, they definitely ate somebody at some point.
This just turned into Hills Have Eyes. Right? Yeah,
like some sort of a horror movie. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
Like, there was a tension that I don't understand why it was there, but it was there, and it was odd.
Mm. I think the first thing that the first impression that I got as soon as I walked out was, is Quentin Tarantino really still the same director that he started out being? Like, I'm all good with creating film for the purpose of the audience that wants it. But when there's a point to where, like, a lot of his movies were graphic, yes, but like the storyline was so complex.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it seems simple enough. Like, you take Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is a layer upon layer upon layer upon layer story.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it was doing Crash before Crash was even thought of. Mm-hmm. You know? This movie, I believe it was claimed by Quentin Tarantino that this movie was going to be similar or even parallel the amount of complexity as Pulp Fiction. And mind you, I'm one of those types of people that I actually really like Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is one of my favorites, for the fact that I love the pacing, the story structure, the timing of how everything works. But I don't know. Like, knowing that now and kind of comparing it, like, I don't think it's anywhere near that. But I feel like it just seemed like it missed the mark for me.
Like, unless this whole movie was a metaphor for something else that I just missed, I don't really think it's that complex of a story.
Yeah, which I don't think it is either. I don't think this movie was complex at all. Like, there was no difficult, there was no story upon story upon story, because the other elements of the film did not produce something I was really engaged with in terms of wanting to follow.
Yeah.
The film, mind you, you got a slew of characters. You got, like I said, Leonardo DiCaprio's Rick Dalton, Brad Pitt, who plays his stunt double Cliff Booth, Margot Robbie, who plays Sharon Tate, Al Pacino, who plays, obviously we're gonna list Al Pacino because he's a more notable name, but Al Pacino plays some studio head who's trying to get DiCaprio's character more jobs as a spaghetti western star. But out of all the names that I just listed, you see Pacino at the beginning, the couple seconds in the middle, and towards the end. Like, I don't think you really see him all that much.
No, he's not in the movie very much at all.
Margot Robbie is a completely underutilized character in this movie, by far.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. Everybody else, like Emile Hirsch, plays a character in the movie. You got, I don't even know the guy's name, whoever it is that plays Roman Polanski. No? Just exactly. I'm just like, I don't know. The guy's in there for like a whole 2 seconds.
Yeah, he was barely in there. Like, yeah. He was there, and then he went to France.
Yeah, exactly. you got, Jay Sebring. Emile Hirsch plays Jay Sebring. I mean, a lot of these people, they didn't do anything for me to actually keep me focused and keep me invested in their storyline. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and if you've been living under a rock, just a heads up, we will be talking about mild spoilers. We're not going to go too deep into like major spoilers, but we will be hitting on a few mild spoilers. So be warned. Obviously, this movie does have a sense in the whole Charles Manson killings. If you're not familiar with that, during 1969, Charles Manson had, I believe, three of his followers, like, kill, like, these people, I believe.
Huh.
I'm trying to remember, because I know the Manson family, they killed Sharon Tate, they killed Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, they killed pretty much everybody that was in the house, and then they ended up getting caught, oddly enough. But it's a trip how, like, this character, the situation itself,
mm-hmm.
is really kind of utilized as a plot device for Quentin Tarantino, much like how Hitler was used in Inglourious Bastards. I don't know if he has this thing where he likes to rewrite history, but I think maybe because World War II is so far off, it was kind of like, okay, like, I get it. How many times have we seen parodies of, like, Hitler being this person who got his comeuppance, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a ton of B movies. Like, we saw that movie. What is that one that was on YouTube, where, what's his name, that Kung Fury, there we go.
Oh, Kung Fury, that was so good.
Where Hitler ends up getting a hold of the time machine and starts going through time as well. This one kind of plays on something that's been interestingly sketched to talk about. Like, I don't know, like, not a lot of people talk about it much, you know. I don't know, have you heard anybody really mention it prior to?
No, I'm just learning now that there was an actual Shantae or whatever her name was. So I actually don't know much about the whole Charles Manson murders.
Yeah, so essentially Polanski was away in business in London, and then on August 9th, Sharon, Jay Sebring, and two other house guests, they dined together at the El Coyote. Later that evening, the pregnant Sharon Tate, her three guests, and another person were murdered by Charles Manson's followers, the three individuals. So three people.
Oh! Is that what was supposed to be happening?
Yeah.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but this movie turns it on its head, that whole situation, and then creates this situation where they end up running into Rick Dalton, go nuts, and after getting, you know, so tripped out on whatever they were taking, they decide, instead of going after Sharon Tate and that whole household, they decide to go and try to kill Rick Dalton.
Okay, that makes the ending make a lot more sense now. Because
maybe, like, we should have had a conversation before going on.
Well, because I don't know anything about the Charles Manson murders. I just know there was a guy named Charles Manson. I thought he was the Kool-Aid guy.
You talking about the Jonestown massacre?
Okay. I thought Charles Manson was the one who killed a whole bunch of people with, like, Kool-Aid that was poisoned.
That's the Jonestown massacre.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something completely different.
So that was in the late 70s.
Okay.
And I don't know. Jim Jones was the guy.
Okay.
That was Jim Jones. No, Charles Manson is the guy who, like, carved in or had, like, a tattoo of, like, something on his forehead, like a pentagram or something.
Oh.
He's a trippy dude. He has a swastika on his forehead. Sorry.
Oh, lovely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of too recent to really be talked about in, like, a history class in school. So,
Are the 60s that recent for you, Spencer?
Well, like, the closest in time that my history classes got me were Martin Luther King and his death, and that was it.
Was that in the late 70s?
No, that was in the 60s, the early 60s.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. There's a lot of click-clacking in this. Oh, 1968. Okay. My bad. What, just because you're... I'm supposed to take you at your word?
Yes!
So, talking back about this movie, it turns it on its head. And, yeah, you know, like I said, I think this movie tries its hardest to be similar to Pulp Fiction in how it stacks the stories. But I think it kind of falls short in that because of the fact that they don't create a strong enough story with the other... the other layers. You have the story from the perspective of Cliff Booth, who's the stunt man. Then you have the story from the perspective of Rick Dalton. And then you have the story from the perspective of Sharon Tate and her whole relationships and whatnot. And then you have the story of what's happening with these girls that are following Charles Manson and are, like, living on this, like, studio ranch area place, whatnot. But none of those arcs are strong enough to really create a worthy enough storyline for me to care. Like, going back to Pulp Fiction, the great thing about Pulp Fiction is you had the storyline of what was going on with Vince and Jules, who are the characters played by Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta. Then you have the storyline of what happens when John Travolta is asked to take his boss's wife out while he's out of town with that Uma Thurman, which Uma Thurman is phenomenal in that movie. And then you have the storyline of Bruce Willis, who's a boxer, and his French girlfriend, who end in this, they end up in, like, this whole craziness. And then you have the storyline that began at the beginning and concludes at the end of the film, which is the two robbers of the restaurant. So that those are all, like, strong, which, mind you, one of them is played by Tim Roth and the other one is, I forget her name all the time, but she was, do you remember Hunger Games Part 2?
I didn't see that one.
Oh my gosh, Spencer. but either way, she was in that movie. I forget her name though. But needless to say, like, those are strong layers. Like, you're really deep in those storylines because you want to see Bruce Willis, you know, not get caught by Marcellus Wallace because he's supposed to take a dive and he ends up killing the other guy in the boxing ring and winning all this money. And so he's on the run. And at the same time, you have John Travolta, who's taking out the boss's wife, and she ends up ODing on what she thought was coke, and it actually is heroin. And he's got to take her to his dealer to figure out how to save her. At the same time as all that, I mentioned earlier, you have the Jules and Vincent whole escapade where Vincent accidentally shoots some guy in the head in the back of Jules' car, and they have to get the car off the road. All those are like great stories, but it's one of those things where it's like, that is engaging enough for me. I don't know if these layers are as engaging to me. I don't know. What do you think? Like, comparatively to something like Crash. Like, I'm assuming you've seen Crash.
No.
Okay. What about the latest Marvel movie where there's multiple characters?
Yeah, I've seen that.
Okay. Well, let's do that. But, like, even in that sense, like, in that itself, like, take, for instance, Endgame. Right. Endgame just dropped on digital, so it's kind of relevant right now. But, like, you have the different layers, the different stories of, like, Nebula and what she's got going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the story of, like, what everybody else is doing, plus Captain Rogers. There's a lot going on. Multi-layered. And it all converges on at the end of the film,
mm-hmm.
you know? So you look at this film, and I don't think there was any secondary or third-rate character in this film that kept me engaged with that storyline, wanting to see more.
No, because, like, Margot Robbie, like, she was fine in what she did, but, like, a lot of the times when we were with her, it was kind of like, why are we here exactly?
Yeah. Why are we following her? Why is she so, like, why is she so important?
Yeah. That was kind of where I was with her in this movie. Not that she did a bad job or anything, but
She could have been, so here's the bottom line. She could have been, that role could have been played by anybody. Mm-hmm. It didn't need to be Margot Robbie. It could have been anybody else, and the role would have been no less powerful.
Yeah.
Or unengaging.
Yeah, no, I don't agree with you on that one.
Because you're watching her, and oh yeah, she's like at the movies. She finally decides she wants to go see the movie that she's in. She's like, oh, I'm in that. I'm Sharon Tate. Oh, blah blah blah.
She still had to pay.
She just exactly. She just didn't want to pay. Like, whatever. but it's like, why? You know, like going back to movies like I mentioned, like let's take for instance Inglourious Basterds.
Hmm.
You take the last act of that movie and you have what's happening at the theater with Brad Pitt's soldiers. You have what's happening with the theater owner and that sniper guy. You have what's happened and what she's plotting. You have what's happening with Christoph Waltz and Brad Pitt and what's his name? BJ Novak.
Hmm.
the only reason why I remember that is because he was a writer in The Office.
Yeah.
but like, you take all these different stories, just those three itself, just those three, and those are engaging enough that I'm like, I'm wanting to know, is Christoph Waltz's character going to get the reprieve? Is he going to get pardoned? What's going to, like, what is Eli Roth and his band of merry soldiers going to do with, you know, all these people there? Is that woman going to be successful in destroying the theater with all those Nazis in there and Adolf Hitler? Like, all these things happening all at once, it's engaging. Like, I'm interested. I am totally stuck in there, and I want to know what happens. And mind you, the film doesn't disappoint at all. But, as I said, those are engaging plot points. This movie didn't have that at all.
Yeah. Like, I was much more interested in Inglourious Basterds, which was... I thought really well done.
It is a really well done movie.
Yeah, this one, it just, like, you're with Rick or Cliff.
Yeah.
And, like, when things are with them, like, you're like, okay, things are moving along. But then whenever you're with, like, someone else or when they're with, like, a third person sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, you're kind of like, okay, like, what? What? that's the feeling it leaves you with, and it's just kind of confusing, I think.
Here's my question to you, and this is a legitimate question. I know this might sound ridiculous, but there have been always rumors that Quentin Tarantino has had a foot fetish.
Do you think, would believe that based on this movie alone.
I was just going to say, would this movie solidify...
There are so many people with their dirty feet just up on things. I don't like to see people's feet. Like,
I don't either.
It's weird to me. And it's too much. Plus, who takes off their shoes at a movie theater? Movie theaters are disgusting.
I don't even know.
And then that hippie lady who had her shoes off, like, her feet look green
her
and
feet
like
were yellow.
Like, she has some sort of medical condition and needs to see a doctor. That's the only thing I can come across. Because human feet, I'm pretty sure, don't look like that normally.
Well, and
like
so...
You must have blood flow issues or something.
Apparently, it's been self-confessed. So Quentin Tarantino has confessed it, mm-hmm. obviously. But if there was ever any doubt as to the level of how much this fetish is a part of his life, it has now made it into his career mm-hmm. fully. Because I don't think there was ever any of those scenes where I did not, A, see somebody with their feet with their shoes off, or B, see their feet prominently displayed in camera view.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder to the statement I said earlier, how Quentin Tarantino had said, quote, that the screenplay was, as quote, probably his most personal.
Well, now that just feels gross. But yeah, like the thing about this movie is that like other movies generally don't show you people's feet this frequently. So you kind of notice, like, very quickly that, hey, I'm seeing the bottoms of a lot of people's feet, and it's weird.
It was gross.
It was the weirdest part of the movie.
And I still can't get out of my mind how yellow that... I mean, I'm not a...
Yeah, that was the one. Her... I call her a doctor somewhere. Yeah. That's
like, or get some type of cutting tool to get off those calluses. If those are calluses, I'm surprised she didn't like scratch up the windows.
Also, everyone, wash your feet. Just wash them.
I went home after watching that movie and was like, I need to clean my feet. My feet feel dirty after watching this movie. Like, if that's even possible. And here's the worst part about it all.
That wasn't the worst part.
Well, okay, that is probably one of the worst parts. But like, one of the worst parts is the fact that that car that they were driving, the yellow Pontiac, I believe, it belongs to Michael Madsen. So after the movie, he had to get his car back after knowing that somebody had their yellow feet on his window.
Well, I would assume he has the money to just be like, someone detail clean this, that,
well,
like
I'm
deep
sure,
clean.
But here's the thing, though. You would still know. Like, it's like one of those things where, have you ever seen, this is going to be gross, but have you ever seen anybody like get on the bus and then pick their nose and then wipe their fingers on a seat and they go sit somewhere else and you're like, there's an open seat, but I just don't want to sit there because I know what that person did. And then you come back the next day on the bus and you're like, I'm not sitting in the booger seat. I know they probably clean the chairs, but I'm not sitting in the booger.
Oh, you know they don't clean those chairs.
I'm giving them benefit of the doubt, but it's like that. It's like, I feel like he's driving and he's like driving and then looks to the right. Driving and looks to the right, like I'm pretty sure, like he's seeing like a ghost outline of that.
No,
yellow
see,
foot.
Here's the thing: when you know your friends, you know also not to ask what they did.
Well, sadly, this is on video, so it's not like he can actually like, oh well, you know what?
Just
you know,
don't go see the movie.
Ignorance is bliss. He's in it. He's in the movie.
Yeah, but was he there for the feet scenes?
No, he was at the very beginning.
There you go.
Poor guy. But like I said, like that's if you're going to a movie and you're recognizing like a person's own libations or like personal fancies, like more prominent than actual like characteristics of what you would come to expect out of a movie from a specific director, I think that kind of says something. It's like, I'm going to go see a Steven Spielberg movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect to see incredible special effects. I expect to see a very family-friendly yet engaging tale. I'm expecting to see something worthy of having the name directed by Steven Spielberg on it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Quentin Tarantino. If I'm coming to see a Quentin Tarantino movie, I expect to see those particular things. I expect to see a movie that emotes everything that is Quentin Tarantino as everything has progressed or evolved to this point. I mean, even Django Unchained, even though it was kind of linear, it was just a one straight shot kind of storyline.
Uh-huh.
I still liked it. It was decent. It was good. Even with all the blood and whatnot, I still think it was a good story. There was great elements of it. It wasn't hyped to be more than a great Western tale. I don't remember Quentin Tarantino coming out and saying, this is going to be the next Pulp Fiction, or this is going to be the next Kill Bill, you know, Django Unchained, Volume 1. You know, like, it was never any of that kind of mess, thank God. Hmm. But I think the fact that he had so much behind it and so much, like, of his own quote-unquote self and personal whatever, feelings, intimacies, you know, fetishes, whatever it is that he had it into this movie, it's sad to say, like, it didn't feel like it was anything better than, yeah, it was good coming out of that movie, you know?
See, this is like the type of movie where I'd be very interested in listening to, like,
the commentary.
The director's commentary track, because there's a few movies out there where I'm like, what were you thinking? What were you thinking when you made this? But like, just what was your headspace?
Yeah,
like, because like, I feel like I would get this movie more if I could understand that.
But have you ever seen an interview done with Quentin Tarantino?
No,
he is notorious for being extremely difficult. So like, I don't know if he would get like offended if you're like, explain yourself here, like, kind of thing. Like,
it's a director's commentary.
Yeah, but it's him. Like, how much is he actually?
There's no interviewer. It's just on the screen. Talk about it.
No, but there's another person in there to help facilitate a conversation at least, or for them to give, like, and if you have somebody in there, it's like right before they're going, like, hey, so you're gonna go in there with Quentin. Can you kind of get an explanation as to why he's putting feet so much in these scenes? Or, you know, why that one girl? Is she jaundiced still? Or does she still have, like, yellowing of the skin that we don't know about? You know, does she need to see a medical professional for her feet?
The answer is yes.
And it's crazy how this film, yes, it does epitomize everything that is late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from the cars to the overall aesthetic,
yeah,
to the vibe itself. Like, you were mentioning about how the soundtrack's unique.
Oh, yeah. So, like, we left theater, and I was like, I want to hear some of that, those movie soundtracks. I like them. They're good. So I had my phone start playing the soundtrack for the film, and it sounded like hot garbage on my speaker. And I was like, what? Like, I know I don't have, like, an amazing setup in here, but this shouldn't sound this bad.
Garbage. It sounded like hot. What does hot garbage sound like?
It sounds like the What the Put. What soundtrack? No. But, like, this soundtrack is basically an hour of, like, a radio station.
Yeah.
Where they have ads, which I don't know how I feel about that.
It's really interesting. I like, thought he was joking the entire time until I looked it up on YouTube, and there really are ads.
Yeah.
I forget, what are their ads for?
Like, one was for Mug Root Beer, which still exists. So, like, I'm feeling like if I were to buy this soundtrack, I'd be slightly upset with the advertisements.
Another one was like tanning butter or something. Like, if you're listening, please be over the age of 25.
No, under.
Oh, don't be under.
No, that's the same thing.
I don't know. They say some kind of whatever.
Yeah. So it was an interesting experience because I found like, there was another track from, like, the actual band on their own single, and it sounded way better. So that was a choice to just make it sound like a radio station.
Hey, more power to him. But it's, I don't know. It's interesting, like, them deciding to go that route and creating more of that, like, 60s vibe. Like, if you watch the movie and you're like, man, I need to, you know, kind of stay in this vein of, like, 60s goodness, then that soundtrack really fills that quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's smart. You know, it's like we were just talking about with one of the more recent episodes where we talked about the movie Yesterday, which I believe it was the last episode. Yes. 171.
Mm-hmm.
Where we talked about how the soundtrack is a lot of Beatles songs, obviously, and the main character singing some of them himself, his own voice. And that's smart because you're doing a movie that brings honor to the Beatles. You want to have a soundtrack that is all great Beatles songs.
Yeah.
This, very much so in that same vein, you're going to have a movie about being in the 60s. You want to have a soundtrack that epitomizes what it feels like, what the feel of being in the 60s, and not just being in the 60s, but being in the 60s while living in LA, you know, I think is the overarching main theme.
I will say that throughout the movie, they do use transition of like driving places with like music in the background.
Yeah.
And those were some pretty good picks because I feel like the songs that they picked were really good tone setters for like the era.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We did touch on it a little bit with Margot Robbie, but there's another individual character in this film that is getting a lot of attention due to the fact of its portrayal and actually how well it's not being, or like how it's not being portrayed well. And that is the role that is Bruce Lee, played by Mike Mo. And there's a lot of conversations, especially ever since the recent comments from Bruce Lee's daughter coming out and saying that she had a horrible experience while she was in the theater, essentially. In so many words, she said, while everyone was at the theater laughing at her dad, she felt like they were laughing at her and that it wasn't fair that they portrayed him in the way he did. It's very interesting how they choose to portray Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
Because personally, I've never met the man, so I don't know how he was like with his friends and when he wasn't off camera.
Right.
Because unfortunately, if he was on camera, I'm pretty sure there was a part of him that was a certain way, like the way he projects himself. But in this film, he is, you know, a very semi-egotistical, confident individual. Like, so setting the scene, they're all sitting on this back lot and Cliff is there waiting. I guess they're on the set of Green Hornet.
Yeah.
And they're all standing around and Bruce Lee's there and Bruce Lee's talking about how, you know, boxers are essentially like they're warriors. They're not just they go beyond just regular athleticism and, you know, they go in to fight to kill when they fight each other. And someone asks him like, hey, you know, who would win in a fight between you and Cassius Clay? And he's like, it would never happen. He's like, well, what would happen if it would? He said, well, Cassius Clay would die or something like that. Something to that effect. And then essentially Cliff chuckles. Bruce takes offense to it, challenges him to a fight. He knocks Cliff down. Then Cliff gets up and totally whoops Bruce Lee's butt, like hardcore style. It's really interesting. But essentially, it's played for comedic laughs and how like Bruce Lee gets taken out by simple acts by Cliff. And to a certain extent, because I was one of those people who, when I was young, I used to really admire Bruce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
My family really loves martial arts movies. So I've seen everything from Enter the Dragon to Fist of Fury to The Chinese Connection. I've seen most of his films. I don't know how I feel. Like on one hand, I can completely understand how his daughter is feeling. And I can completely like validate. Yeah, I would be upset if like I was in it. Oddly enough, it's like in the scene of, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Dragon. Dragon is the movie. It's like a biopic on Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee's played by Jason Scott Lee. Jason Scott Lee was the guy from Back to the Future 2. He's like, unless you got power.
So that's how you make things connect with me.
There you go. But essentially, there's a scene in that movie where Bruce Lee is sitting in a theater with his then-girlfriend, and they're watching Breakfast at Tiffany's. I don't know if you've seen Breakfast at Tiffany's, but there's a scene in that movie where when Audrey Hepburn is going, she's either getting harassed or she's going upstairs to go see or leaving her apartment or whatever. Mickey Rooney, who's another attendant, Mickey Rooney, to everybody's knowledge, is a white guy.
Yeah.
He actually plays an Asian gentleman.
Yeah.
And his name is Mr. Yunioshi. And he's his portrayal is extremely stereotypical and racist.
Yeah.
And in the theater, when Bruce Lee and his girlfriend are watching it, like, everybody's laughing, and Bruce Lee's looking around, and he's like, he's embarrassed because, like, everybody's laughing at him. But to him, it feels like they're laughing at him. And so this kind of parallels that for me, like, oh my gosh, like, she's feeling that way about her own father, about the portrayal of her own father. So I can see it that way. Like, I can see kind of a misstep on Quentin Tarantino's end. Mm-hmm. But what do you think? How do you feel?
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, no. Just no. Yeah. Like, this is not, like, for some reason they just decided to go with, like, this caricature of Bruce Lee in this movie instead of, like, you know, leaning into more of the actual person.
Yeah.
Which, that's not a wise idea when it's, like, this close in the time. Like, he was only around, like, you know, 40 or so years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, like, if you were doing this about some other person who lived over 100 years ago, that's a way different story. But, like, I don't know. He just never kind of portrayed himself as such an arrogant person.
Yeah.
And even the stuff I've read about him, like, that just doesn't line up in, like, a weird way.
And I 100% agree, because I don't ever remember hearing him being a confrontational person.
Yeah.
Like, the whole idea of his fighting style is essentially based on the defense of, you know, being in a fight. It's not meant to engage a fight. It's essentially there to diffuse or to sidestep a fight. So I don't know why they chose to go that route. I don't really believe that it was okay. I'm pretty sure, like, I have a lot of friends. We mentioned this off air. I have a lot of friends who help bring a lot of attention to the Asian representation in film and theater and so forth. And so this was one of those things where a lot of people are speaking out, and a lot of my friends are speaking out. And it's true. Like, this is really wrong. I get it. Quentin Tarantino is the type of person who will push past racial boundaries, not just for a laugh, but to accentuate a certain character, a certain point in the film. But I don't see where this made any valid point. Like, you take it, for instance, in Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino's character says the N-word, like, full on white way, not even, like, you know, and he's like, did you see a sign on the front of my house that said dead in storage? Because the guy that they killed in the backseat was black. But, like, he says that, and it's like, that's kind of pushing it, Quentin. Like, you're not allowed to say that. when people have to say the N-word instead of the actual name, you know the word is not proper. So this is one of those things where it's like, they might as well have, like, called Bruce Lee a racial slur, because essentially he was not even anything close to what he should have been represented as. And I get it. This is like an alternate universe, because of the things that happen in the movie, but
yeah, but if you're gonna say alternate universe, you need to like lean really hard into that to make certain things clear. I didn't even realize that this was based on the actual like Charles Manson murders till you told me right now. I didn't realize that this was like some of these people were actual people.
Yeah. You've never seen the Valley of the... Well, never mind. You've never seen the Valley of the Dolls.
I thought they were made up movies.
These are all real movies, except for... Well, except for the actual... Like, for a lot of the Sharon Tate scenes that they showed on, in the film, those were movies. That was actually the real actress. They didn't put Margot Robbie in those roles.
Yeah, at first I was like, that's a bad stunt double.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, seriously, they're removing other people and putting these people in, but they won't do that for her? Like, is she just not that... substantial enough in this film that they're not going to do that? But then I read they're like, oh, we're going to keep, they kept the original Sharon Tate in all those scenes because she's such a powerhouse and she's this, this, and that. I'm like, oh, okay, sure.
All right.
Like, I'm not one to judge, but sure.
And Margot Robbie can't be a powerhouse in those scenes either?
Apparently not.
Okay. I mean, because we put Leo in, what was that, The Great Escape?
The Great Escape, yeah. Like, he's literally prominently in those roles reading those lines. So, I don't know. It's just, it's a lot to take in. And mind you, the film does have its comedic parts. There are parts in this film that, like, really, really highlight the comedy that Quentin can do in his films. But, nevertheless, it's still meh, you know? Like, it's not anything great. Like, I didn't leave the film and was like, dude, that was almost as good, if not as good as Pulp Fiction. Like, here's the difference. I can go home right now, and I can turn on Pulp Fiction, and I can watch it, and I can be engaged, and maybe I won't get through the whole film, but I promise you the next day that I get a chance to, I'll put it back on, and I'll watch it, because it's a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have much of an interest to see this one again. You know, and I think that says a lot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. For me, I like this movie, but...
Which is fine. I mean, you can like it. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, I'm good. I also don't need to, like, waste, like, spend another 2.5 hours watching this again.
Yeah.
Like, tomorrow.
Thank God. And mind you, I mean, hey, this movie received a 7-minute standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
That, you know what? Hey, if there's people that like it, by all means, you do you. I'm not one to judge. I just...
But that does bring in the question of, like, 7 minutes, really? Like, like right now, at home, clap for a minute. And that is too long. So 7 minutes seems insane.
Yeah, I don't know. So, wrapping this all up, let's go ahead and go down the list. And did you have any other complaints or thoughts about the film before we give our thought, our final anything?
So let's talk about the hippie compound for just
sure.
A quick second. So was this part of history?
The Spahn Ranch?
Yeah.
I believe so.
So Charles Manson had a whole hippie commune there?
At Spahn Ranch? I don't know if it was directly at Spahn Ranch, but...
Because now that we're bending in and out of reality, like, I'm confused at a certain bits. Because...
Ah, here we go.
Okay.
Spahn Ranch is notorious for having been the primary residence of Charles Manson and his followers... for much of 1968 and 1969.
Okay. This starts to make more sense on what was happening at that ranch.
Spahn Ranch, also known as the Spahn Movie Ranch, was a 55-acre movie ranch in L.A. Successful Iverson movie ranch. Yeah, they filmed movies there. They did everything. And then, the Manson family lived there. And then there was a fire that destroyed it in 70.
Yeah, because, like... Those hippies, when Cliff is there and he wants to see his old friend who owns that land,
yeah,
everyone just gets hella tense. And you're like, why is this a problem? And because he's there and He's like, yeah, yeah, I told them they could stay here, blah, 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 blah.
Well, it's it says Spawn was 80 years old, going blind and living at his ranch when he allowed the Manson family to move in rent-free in exchange for labor. The family did daily chores and helped run the horse rental business, which had become Spawn's main source of income. Manson family member Lynette later wrote, I was impressed with George Spann's hardiness. He was 80 years old, and although his blindness had for 5 or 6 years kept him in a world apart, he was mentally still present, living alone, and working through all the frustrations of having lost authority in the running of his own business. Spawn was never accused of any role in the many murders for which members of the family were later convicted. Apparently it's a real place. It does look like a whole different world all in itself. But then I'm pretty sure there's a lot of places in LA that used to be film lots and whatnot that now are just ghost towns.
Yeah. Okay. So it seems like if you're going to go see this movie, you should have a vague understanding of the Charles Manson murders. Because, like, while you can see it without it, I'm sure it would make slightly more sense.
I mean, that would help. No offense to anybody who wants to take on the task on their own.
Well, because without seeing it, I was just like, what is going on during this whole scene? Because people are freaking out, and I don't quite understand why. I expected Cliff to find his friend dead and them to all just start attacking him because, but like, no, he was just there in the back. And it's like, why? But now that I know that they're just crazy people who murdered people,
they are.
That makes way more sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions I have. Like, I don't know. There's just so many different things, like, that I have questions about it. And, like, Cliff Booth, like, is he based on an actual character? Because apparently Cliff Booth is kind of blackballed in parts of Hollywood because of the fact that he may or may not have accidentally or intentionally killed his wife. Like, and that doesn't really get explained.
Yeah.
There's a lot that happens, but
yeah, I wasn't sure if that was an actual thing or if that was just a rumor.
I don't know.
Because, like, they don't touch on it enough, so I'm like, okay, I guess this might have happened
at one point in time.
Yeah.
Who knows? So, wrapping it all up, let's go ahead and figure out, all right, does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Well, this movie passes. It is a watchable film, so it by default passes for me. You know, it would be a bit more helpful if they had explained, like, maybe a connection to Charles Manson. Because I don't even think they mention his name at all in the movie.
They say Charlie.
Oh.
But that's it. That's all they say.
Well, yeah, lots of people are named Charlie. Like that kid from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I'm going to give this movie a 3. Like, you know, I liked it, but some things could have been explained a bit more. Characterizations of people who actually existed should probably be handled with a bit more care. Because if you're going to go through all this trouble for Sharon Tate, you should probably do the same amount for Bruce Lee.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I can see that. This movie was interesting enough for me that I'm going to give it a pass. It does pass as a film. However, with everything that this film faces and what it perpetuates and the expectations that fell through for me when it came to seeing a recent Quentin Tarantino film, I don't know if it hits the stars with me all that much, and I'm probably going to have to drop it to a 2.5.
I thought you were going to do that too.
The film meets the standards of what I come to expect, but it doesn't build on it. Like, all right, you're going to do this. I get it. You're going to do that. You're going to do a scene, you know, like this. You're going to do these things. You're going to use excessive violence. You're going to do something ridiculous. You're going to bring in a flamethrower. I don't know. Like, craziness.
That flamethrower was amazing.
It was. And mind you, there are really great standout moments in this film, but I think altogether, the film kind of is a meh for me, and so I'm going to put it right square in the center and give it a 2.5. Okay. So that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out at our website at filmlosophers.com, or let us know what you think. Have you had a chance to check out the film? Let us know your thoughts on our web, on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers, and our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Just to let you know of a couple of upcoming weekend releases, we got Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. So
yes.
Check it out.
Let's see this.
Because this looks interesting.
It looks insane.
It looks interesting.
It looks insane.
So, wrapping this up, it was a great conversation. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.